Hey, your mics are on.
All right.
Hey, Jim.
Hi.
Hey. Anna.
Thank you.
Madam Commissioner. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the November 10th edition of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would please all rise and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And Madam Clerk, the changes to today's agenda, please.
Today's changes are added items to the closed session. Under pending litigation, conference with legal counsel, existing litigation, number 16, Elrod versus the County of San Luis Obispo et al., 17, Herrera et al. Versus County of San Luis Obispo, 18, Page versus County of San Luis Obispo, 19, Edna Valley Watch versus County of San Luis Obispo et al., 20, Sierra Club versus County of San Luis Obispo et al., 21, Barrow versus the County of San Luis Obispo. Under item 3, conference with real property negotiator, it is the intention of the board to meet in closed session to have a conference with its real property negotiator concerning the following. Number 22, property description, 801 Grand Avenue, San Luis Obispo, parties with whom negotiating, Denny Jones, Administrative Office of the Courts, instructions to negotiator, price, terms, and conditions. 23, property description, 1145 Monterey Street, San Luis Obispo, parties with whom negotiating, Denny Jones, Administrative Office of the Courts, instructions to negotiator, price, terms, and conditions. Number 24, property description, 1355 Kansas Avenue, Unit D, San Luis Obispo, parties with whom negotiating, Denny Jones, Administrative Office of the Courts, instructions to negotiator, price, terms, and conditions. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied, as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. And those are your changes.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. That brings us to our consent agenda. And I do not have any requests to speak on consent. And seeing no one coming forward, we'll go ahead and close that to the public, bring it back to the board for colleagues to pull items for comment. Mr. Hill.
None, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shadjian.
I do some, thank you.
Mr. Patterson.
Item A1 for comment.
And Mr. Meacham.
None, sir.
And I'll make a brief comment on A2. A1, Mr. Patterson.
Yes, item A1 is the appointment of Deb Garrison to the Agricultural Liaison Advisory Board. She's being appointed as the environmental representative on ALAB, and I want to welcome her to that position. Deb is a multi-generational agriculturist in San Luis Obispo County and on the Central Coast. She's replacing Ann McMahon, who served the environmental community well on ALAB. Unfortunately, Ann McMahon is suffering some very serious health issues currently and had to resign her position on ALAB. She had previously worked as my legislative assistant and was instrumental, along with Deb Garrison, in establishing the Central Coast Ag Network. And prior to that, she had worked with the local office of the Nature Conservancy, and she worked extensively with the agricultural community in establishing conservation programs on the Central Coast. And I just wanted to thank Ann again for her service on ALAB and all the other work she's done for us in the county, and wish her and her family well.
And indeed, our thoughts and prayers go out to Ann and her friends and family.
Yes.
On A2 is a resolution recognizing Jude Long for her dedicated service to the Morro Bay Library. Ms. Long is just shy of 35 years working in the Morro Bay Library, just about every job that I think that institution has on its roster. And I just wanted to take a minute to publicly acknowledge her work and the central role that she plays in the community of Morro Bay. We have, you know, a tremendous library system, and the Morro Bay Library is a beehive of community centeredness, if you will. Jude's right in the middle of it. There will be a celebration of her career a week from this Friday at noon at the library. And again, just wanted to take this opportunity to congratulate her and thank her on a tremendous career in the library. With that, we would entertain a motion for
approval of the consent agenda item.
That's what I was looking for.
Second.
And thank you, Mr. Meacham. Madam Clerk, a roll call vote.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. That brings us then to presentations, a motion on presentations. Thank you.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. And another roll call vote.
Mr. Sajid.
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Our first presentation is to two individuals who've done something extraordinary. I wonder if we might have Maricela Campos and Dr. Daniel Lapidus.
I was going to ask, Mr. Chairman, if you could switch the order of the presentation.
So we might, we'll delay that
They're
one.
We're not here yet.
Yeah, all right. Very good.
Thank you very much.
We'll move on to our second presentation, recognizing November 2009 as Native American Heritage Month.
Okay. Fred and company, if you'd like to come to the podium, it's my pleasure. This is a resolution recognizing November as Native American Heritage Month. Whereas the ancestors of Native American peoples inhabited the land of the present-day San Luis Obispo County since time immemorial and for thousands of years before the arrival of peoples of European descent, and whereas Native Americans have for millennia honored, protected, and stewarded this land we cherish, now known as San Luis Obispo County, and whereas the County of San Luis Obispo recognizes the special relationship the Native American community has with the local government and solemn covenant with the land we share, and whereas Native American peoples are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among those being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize November as Native American Heritage Month.
Fred,
why don't you come back? The gentleman wants to take a picture. We'll
oh, okay.
pose for him.
Sure.
If you want to take your guest with you?
Yeah. Yeah. This is my daughter, Violet Cavanaugh.
Oh, great.
Why don't you center him, open the resolution, be sure it's upside. always the details.
Paparazzi approaching.
A little late.
Mr. Collins.
Again, I'm Fred Collins. I'm tribal administrator for the Northern Chumash Tribal Council, and from the bottom of my heart, I thank you. You know, it's been an amazing journey for the Native American community, and it's a new dawn for us. I believe that working together with the community in a way where we can all reach the same goals is so important. And I think that, you know, this board exemplifies that. And so, again, I personally thank you. The ancestors who aren't here who have, you know, cleared this pathway for me to stand here. And it's an honor to be here and to speak for them and to also speak for all the families that couldn't be here today in San Luis Obispo because of other commitments and work commitments. It's an honor for all of us to be able to stand here with the county, embracing each other in this work that we do to reach the same goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Appreciate your being here. Our next presentation will be made by Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we have some folks from hospice here.
And on a more personal note, our family has had the services of hospice over the couple of years, and an extraordinary organization and one that is that serves the community so well. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Last year, approximately 1,400,000 terminally ill patients and their families relied on end-of-life care provided by the 4,700 volunteer and licensed hospice agencies located in communities throughout the United States. And hospice care allows patients and families the opportunity to receive professional medical services, pain and symptom control, and emotional and spiritual support without hospitalization. And hospice creates a compassionate atmosphere where patients are able to die with dignity, whether they are at home, surrounded and supported by loved ones, familiar friends, and committed caregivers. Hospice Partners of the Central Coast and Hospice of San Francisco County provide hospice care and bereavement counseling, respectively, to over 5,000 individuals each year within the County of San Luis Obispo. This observance is an opportunity to encourage, honor, and support the professionals, volunteers, and family caregivers who take on the challenge of caring for patients and loved ones at the end of life. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim November 2009 as National Hospice Month and encourage citizens to increase their awareness of the importance and availability of hospice services within San Luis Obispo County.
Before you go too far, we'll get you in the center here for a gentleman to...
On behalf of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, I would like to thank very much the Board of Supervisors for their ongoing support of all hospice care in our community. As the county's volunteer hospice, I would like to recognize and thank the many volunteers that have chosen our agency as a way to support their community and meaningful and soulful counseling, practical, and emotional support they provide at the end of life and through the grief process. I would also like to recognize particularly and commend our colleagues at Hospice Partners of the Central Coast for the excellence of the care they bring to the community. Many folks wonder and ask why and how we are able to do this work. And as a former volunteer myself, I can tell you it has everything to do with hope and the love that is inherent somewhere in all human connections. Thank you again for your belief in that support and those connections.
Thank you. I'm Janet Jeffrey. I'm the administrator for Hospice Partners of the Central Coast, and I thank you for the recognition today. It seems that every year brings something new and exciting, and this year, aside from my hearing and vision challenges, front and center is healthcare reform. One of the areas of healthcare that does not demand reform is licensed, certified end-of-life care, and I want to take the opportunity to tell you of three big reasons, among many others. There is universal access. In San Luis Obispo and our service area, Hospice Partners turns not a single qualified client away. Number two, the benefit is elected by the patient and family, not required, and the care is patient goal driven. That means the patient chooses, not their provider. Number three, it's cost effective. I challenge anyone to name another level of health care that delivers all-inclusive care for well under $200 a day. All-inclusive. And it includes professional care, equipment, drugs, supplies, after-hours services, and grief and bereavement care for at least 13 months after the client's death. 12 years ago this month, the Board of Supervisors privatized the hospice program the county operated, and Hospice Partners took over. I stood before you then and promised to maintain the quality and integrity of your hospice program. I stand before you now, older, a lot wiser, and grayer, all for the wonders of peroxide. Now to thank you for your decision of November 1997. Hospice Partners is a nationally recognized hospice program. We serve 130 to 150 patients every single day. Our staff and volunteers together number 260. Our services are among the best in all of the land. We operate consistently with the highest quality, ethics, and efficiency, and I'd like you to note that we've been in the black 4 years, including last year and this year. So I thank you. Our staff thanks you, our volunteers thank you, and our clients especially thank you for the opportunity you've afforded Hospice Partners 12 years ago. We will continue to aggressively help patients and families as they work through the last phase of life. It's not about death, it's about life. Dying happens on the last day. All the rest of the days are about living. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Janet. And thanks to both wonderful organizations that serve human needs in a great way in this county. I too have had contact with hospice in one form or another, one program or another, and you truly do make a huge difference in people's lives. We thank you very much.
We're proud to do it.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamm, should we delay a bit more, or shall we carry on?
Dr. Lapidus is here.
Okay.
Ironically, Marcella is traveling down from Paso with a couple of the staff from our clinic up there, and they got stuck in traffic on the grade.
We can go to public comment. In fact, we can, if Dr. Lapidus is available to
we
hang
have,
in there for a little while, we'll...
We have about 20 minutes. So
okay.
If you do that, that'd be great.
Well, we'll go ahead and hold on the last presentation on our presentation calendar and move to general public comment items not on the agenda. Do have a couple of requests to speak. We'll start with Piper Riley, followed by Gwen Taylor. Quite all right.
Thank you. Sweet. Good morning, board. I'm Piper Riley from Los Osos. This piece of debris that I hold in my hand is a piece of the Berlin Wall that my stepfather helped tear down 20 years ago. At that point, the people rose up and said, enough. They understood the following quote by Thomas Jefferson: a government big enough to give you everything you want is strong enough to take everything you have. 3 years ago, this board and county restarted on the road of sole sourcing for the LOWWP. I stated at that point that sole sourcing would not leave us to an affordable or green project, but I was ignored. Then multiple environmental groups chimed in, and they were ignored. What we have found is that this current project is not going to change the nitrate levels, which it was intended to do. And what is being ignored in the process is decades of saltwater intrusion that are about to decimate our water supply. Besides mismanaging water resources throughout the entire county, this board continues to ignore and manipulate information in order to ensure that the same engineers and consultants and miscellaneous firms continue on the same path. This is a path that does not do any environmental good and will force out the poor and middle class out of coastal towns. And it makes sure that friends and business partners retain lucrative contracts. Cleef, Wallace, Tuckfield, Montgomery, Watson, Harza, all here again, pushing through questionable projects. We have been limited in our speech for public comment at Supervisor Gibson's office hours, as well as in our appeals of the LOWWP. The process has been manipulated to such an extent that even seasoned veterans in this political arena aren't sure what is going on. For the record, I am filing a complaint against the county to ensure that I have exhausted all of my administrative remedies. So far, the county has stalled on many of our public records requests, and our appeals from the 218 until now have been summarily dismissed. Evidence has been manipulated, and that is a crime, as is backdating contracts, which Pavel Obergin instructed Bruce Buell to do. And Warren Jensen is not exactly an impartial judge in this matter, since he was actively involved with orchestrating the LOWWP along with Gail Wilcox and Pavel Obergin. So it does need to be investigated by a third party. Montgomery Watson Harza was stopped in Cape Coral, but not until many of the townspeople's lost their homes. Is that what we can look forward to? That is not what I bargained for when I bought my home to raise my family in just a few years ago. Please honor the Native American Heritage Month. Do not rip apart Los Osos for the gravity sewer. Please do the low-impact design.
Thank you, Ms. Riley. Ms. Taylor, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor. I'm a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition Zone. We have had many discussions at public comment. We've also at office hours of Mr. Gibson in reference to the ISJ. The task 1, 2, and 3 of the ISJ was approved June the 5th, 2008. It is now November 10th, 09, and this work program has not been completed. The ISJ has a cost-sharing schedule as follows: 20% for the county, S&T 4%, Golden State Water 37%, and Los Osos 39%. The 39% is paid by the community of total Los Osos. That includes all the basin that overlies the shared ground water. Yet the Los Osos wastewater project is being charged under the ISJ cost sharing, which is being charged to the budget of the prohibition zone. You might want to check that out. Is this equitable for one area of the community to pay the major cost of the basin management plan when the seawater intrusion affects the whole community? We all draw our water from the one basin. A budget, when determined, should be adhered to. The wastewater project is not a bottomless pit of funds. Has an accounting of the funds approved by the county for the wastewater project ever been accounted for? You might want to check that also. Please take into consideration that the community is also questioning the consultants that the ISJ is using. As Ms. Riley said, there have been many questions as to those that are now being used as consultants. They have faltered in the past. They are faltering now. Their figures do not add up. 2 and 2 makes 4. Remember that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Greening, followed by Sarah Christie.
Thank you. Good morning. The recently revealed draft of the short-range transit plan is proposing draconian service cuts in southern Atascadero, south Atascadero, Garden Farms, and Santa Margarita, going from 14 daily round trips to 2. While you are only part of the RTA board, there are issues of compliance with county ordinances and plans that obligate you as the boards to collectively resist this. Let's go to San Luis Obispo County Code Title 22, as revised in June 08. This is 22.104.020, quote, where determined appropriate by the regional transit agency, subdivisions or development of 50 or more housing units shall provide pedestrian access to a bus stop along the closest major arterial or collector and pay for their share of one shelter or bus stop per 1/2 mile of that road. It's very clear the intent is that the collectors, the places where people live and work, shall be served, not put the bus on the freeway and go around them. And every time there's been an approval of a receiving site in South Atascadero TDC, El Camino is referred to as a transit corridor to help justify that. Let's move to Santa Margarita. We'll go to 22.104.040. It's called development shall be located for convenient access to potential transit and to neighborhood convenience and civic functions in downtown Santa Margarita. Again, the intent is the transit will be walkable. You don't get in a car and drive to Atascadero for a park and ride. You may not have a car. Let's go to the EIR on the Santa Margarita Ranch. 4.12-55. Wait a minute, here we go. Page 4.2-11. Emission reductions may include funding expansion of existing transit services. That's in Santa Margarita. Page 4.2-31. The agriculture residential cluster subdivision shall further offset greenhouse gas emissions by improving nearby transit amenities to help expand the interest and use of transit, thus reducing vehicle trips, fossil fuel consumption, etc. I asked how ongoing service expansions could be funded by a one-time fund, and the answer that came back was, this doesn't depend on a one-time fee. The APCD will ensure that any ongoing efforts are supported in the long term as applicable. These are not efforts to have people drive to a Tascadero to a park and ride. These are efforts to increase, not decrease, but increase the service in Santa Margarita and adjacent communities. Please remember that as a board. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Christie, followed by Richard Margetson.
Good morning, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. I am Sarah Christie, the current chair of the Planning Commission, and I reside in Creston in the Werowaro watershed. The last time I spoke to you was about a month ago when you had a request to interpret the temporary events ordinance before you. I'm back now a month later to update you on how the first application of your interpretation has been applied. On Friday, October 30th, planning staff approved a minor use permit for 12 events at 150 attendees per event at the intersection of 46 and Dover Canyon Road. Once again, the agricultural commissioner had recommended that this site did not have enough agriculture on it to be considered primary ag use of the site. 3 acres of vineyards did not qualify it for temporary events. Once again, planning staff chose not to listened to the Ag Commissioner's recommendation and went ahead with the approval. What is even more problematic about this approval is that it's a two-phase minor use permit, wherein the second phase of the permit, within 10 years, is going to be the construction of a winery and a tasting room. In other words, currently there is no winery and tasting room. If this application had been processed under the winery ordinance, they would have qualified under a minor use permit for 6 events of 80 attendees per event. But because they don't have a winery or a tasting room, they're getting double the amount that they would qualify for if they had a winery. A winery requesting that level of events would have had to get a conditional use permit with a full hearing before the Planning Commission. The condition for the permit included that if they build a tasting room and a winery within 10 years, that the current level of activities, of events, will vest with the permit. This is a back door around the conditional use permit process for wineries and all other events. And I submit to you that unless this gets appealed, and at this point in time it is not assured that it will get appealed, which is why I'm bringing it to your attention, unless this gets addressed, I submit to you that there will never be another winery or any other activity that will apply for a conditional use permit, which is 180 degrees from the purpose of the winery ordinance in the first place. Winery ordinance was supposed to make it easier to provide a higher dispensation for wineries to get events because of the nature of their agricultural activity. But why would any winery owner in their right mind now apply for anything other than a minor use permit under temporary events when they can get an unlimited amount of events under that process? This is a significant planning issue, and I urge your board to either appeal it on your own motion or direct planning staff that when they get temporary events applications for more than 6 events, to send them to the Planning Commission.
Thank you, Ms. Christie. And my last request to speak, Mr. Margetson.
Richard Margetson, December 12th, as you may already know, is the Needs and Wishes fundraiser in Los Osos for the Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter. Over the years, we've attempted to expand our base of support, and that's why I'm here today. Since you don't have a meeting next week, I came this week to announce that New Frontiers Natural Marketplace, they're located at 896 Foothill Boulevard in San Luis. The 18th, which is a Wednesday, the entire day, and they're open from 8 a.m. till 9 p.m., is going to give 5% of gross receipts to the Christmas fundraiser, and they will be coming that day to present their check at the event. So if you shop there on a regular basis. Save your shopping that week until that day. Every penny counts. 5% adds up. They did this for us a couple years ago, and it amounted to over $1,800. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson, and thank you for your work with these fundraisers for the Maxine Lewis Shelter. It's greatly appreciated. That was our last request to speak. We'll close it to the public and come back to the board. Mr. Patterson, you had a comment?
Yes, I just wanted to follow up with Mr. Greening regarding the short-range transit plan and the presentation at the RTA meeting last week. Those recommendations by the consultant were very preliminary and weren't made as formal recommendations to the board, and I guarantee you that before we make any service cuts at that level, anywhere throughout the system, we'll have a thorough public vetting of those service cuts. And, you know, I just, again, we were reassured, and I want to reassure you that that is not something that's currently being considered.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Patterson. I think that is an important one. We'll move back to our presentation calendar and invite Maricela Campos and Dr. Daniel Lapidus to the lecterns, please. As I said in the introduction, these two fine folks were engaged in something extraordinary, and we're here to honor their sense of commitment to their fellow human beings. This is a resolution recognizing Maricela Campos and Dr. Daniel Lapidus for outstanding service, and it reads as follows. Whereas on September 19th, 2009, Maricela Campos, a physical therapy aide with the County Health Agency's California Children's Services Program, and Dr. Daniel Lapidus, a local dentist, intervened in a life-threatening event. And whereas on that day, all southbound traffic on Highway 101 on the Cuesta Grade was stopped due to a traffic accident. It seems like that might be a recurring theme in Ms. Campos' life. And if there's something extraordinary that happened on your way in, please don't hesitate to tell us about that. Among the cars waiting for traffic to clear was a family headed to Cal Poly. One of the family members, George Allison, choked on some food, suffered cardiac arrest, and became unconscious. And whereas Maricela Campos and Dr. Lapidus saw the family needing help, offered assistance, and quickly determined the need to perform CPR, Ms. Campos performed chest compressions while Dr. Lapidus performed rescue breaths. They worked together for about 10 minutes until a California Highway Patrol helicopter was able to land and use a defibrillator to restore Mr. Allison's heart rhythm. And whereas paramedics then arrived on the scene in an ambulance and transported Mr. Allison to Sierra Vista Regional Medical Center for treatment, and whereas Maricela Campos and Dr. Lapidus' quick action, medical skills, and knowledge of CPR were instrumental in saving the life of George Allison from Carson City, Nevada, who was visiting family in San Luis Obispo, now therefore be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that Maricela Campos and Dr. Daniel Lapidus be and hereby are commended for their actions that day in administering life-saving aid to a fellow citizen. Center here would be happy to and you both are welcome to offer comments, and I don't know if Mr. Hamm might follow you up at this point.
I just want to thank you all, and also I just want to say to the public not to hesitate and stop and save a life, because a lot of people think about it and don't actually do anything about it. But last time when we were there, I didn't think about it. I just parked my car and I just tried to save somebody, and I didn't think about anything, what was going to happen. I just kept going, and with Dr. Lopez, we just worked really hard, and I feel honored also to work for the county, and I thank you all, and not to hesitate, and don't think about it, and just save somebody.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I thought it was very fitting that the day after this occurred, Dr. Gupta, or am I saying his name right? I'm going to get it incorrect. Had published an article in the Tribune that was published throughout the world about the importance of CPR and how those first 6-10 minutes, especially in a situation like the grade where there aren't access roads, and if something happens and you get stuck in traffic, there's not much that can happen, where those few minutes are really vital. Since then, I've been working really hard to institute a Cal Poly CPR program for anybody who's interested, working with Lexi Pearl's husband, John Pearl, who is a CPR instructor. So I'd like any input or any potential to make that more readily advertised and available for anybody in the community who's willing to do it. The fact that Maricela was there and that, you know, I was there. The fact that just having that rudimentary knowledge of CPR can really save a life. And so I'd like to see if we can expand that service to whoever's interested.
Okay, very good. Maybe Mr. Hamm can...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Good morning, Jeff Hamm, Health Agency Director. Just wanted, on behalf of Maricela's peers, many of whom are here from the Children's Medical Services Division of the Public Health Department and all the rest of the health agency staff, express our appreciation to both Maricela and Dr. Lapidus for their decisive action. And I think Maricela will agree. Part of the reason that she was able to act as she did was because of the knowledge that she possesses. And so I was going to plug CPR and first aid training, but instead I'm going to let Tammy do it because she was here this morning to do that very thing. So thank you for your time, your flexibility this morning, and thank you very much, both of you, for your
absolutely
important actions.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Tammy Douglas Schatz, Human Resources. I wanted to take this timely opportunity to describe the Human Resources Safety Office and the Safety Committee's efforts to provide CPR and first aid training to county employees. So far, we've trained about 150 employees this year and about that many last year through the Red Cross or a Red Cross affiliate. And that training, you get CPR training, first aid training, and AED training. AED stands for Automated External Defibrillator. And we have three AED machines here in this office. We've got one on the first floor outside of board chambers, one on the second floor in the auditor controller's office, one in your offices upstairs on the fourth floor, and 23 fixed locations throughout the county. So we're hoping that more employees will take advantage of this training. We have classes every 3 months or so. Our next class is in January. We had one in October. We'll have one again in January. We have an interest list, so if any county employees out there want to get on our interest list for the next class, we encourage them to do so. And any questions can go to the county safety officer or their departmental safety representative.
Right. Thank you very much. So we'll look forward as that approaches. Maybe you could come back, and if you have spots to fill there, we'll make sure we advertise that again, because we know that's a big deal, and we see how it's paid off. So
I will. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We're good on that then. So we move now to our public hearings. Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our first hearing item.
Item C1 is a hearing to consider a request by People's Self-Help Housing Corporation to approve the issuance of tax-exempt bonds by the California Statewide Communities Development Authority to finance acquisition and rehabilitation of Rolling Hills Apartments, a 53-unit affordable rental housing development in Templeton. First District, recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson Gibson and members of the board, Morgan Terrell, planning staff. This is a request by People's Self-Help Housing for your board to approve the issuance of tax-exempt bonds to pay for a portion of the cost of acquiring and rehabilitating a 53-unit affordable apartment complex in Templeton. The project is called Rolling Hills, and it's located on Los Tablas Road. The county has allocated over $1.6 million in home funds so far for this project, in federal home funds, and can enable the issuance of up to $6 million in tax-exempt financing for this project by approving the tax resolution. The county will not incur any financial or legal liability by approving these bonds. This concludes my presentation. I'm available for questions.
All right. Any questions of Ms. Terrell? Seeing none, we will open it to the public. I have no requests to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board for action.
Mr. Chairman, I would make a motion that we approve staff's recommendation to adopt the attached resolution.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Patterson. And a roll call vote.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. You would then introduce our second hearing, please.
Item C2 is a hearing to consider resolutions to adopt the annual report and action plan prepared in conformance with the Title 29 Affordable Housing Fund and to adopt an annual adjustment of the in-lieu housing impact fee schedules of Title 29. All districts recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson, Chuck Stevenson, planning staff. Ted Bench will be making the presentation this morning, and with him is Dana Lilly, the supervising planner.
Thank you, and good morning to the board. Could I have the PowerPoint presentation up on the screen? Thank you. Okay, again, we're talking about Title 29. This is the time that the board, the county, look at the annual report and consider fee adjustments. There we go. Okay, really briefly, Title 29 is the Affordable Housing Fund, and it was only less than a year ago, December 8th of 2008, that the county approved and adopted Title 29 and the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance. And the board also adopted a five-year phasing plan to implement this new ordinance. And what's on the screen now is the five-year phasing plan as it would apply to a new housing project. You can see that, and when the ordinance is in full effect, that 20% of the new housing is required to be affordable to workforce families or moderate or low-income families. Again, because of the five-year phase-in period we're going through, we're in year one, where only 4% of the new units would be required to be affordable. Now, developers can pay fees that are building those affordable units. And so what's on the screen now is a fee that a developer would pay for an average-sized single-family unit, market rate unit, if he chose to pay a in-lieu fee rather than to provide an affordable unit. And you can see that when at year five, when the ordinance is in full effect, that each developer is expected to pay about $20,000 into the Title 29 Affordable Housing Fund. Again, we're in year one, so the developers are only required to pay about $4,000 today if he chooses to pay the fee. The ordinance also applies to commercial development. So what's on the screen now is the fee schedule that would be applied to a new 10,000 square foot retail store. Now, Title 29, the Affordable Housing Fund, requires an annual report and an annual action plan. And the purpose of the annual report is to report how much money has been collected and how it was spent. What we have today is the first annual report. And I have to tell you that a very small fee amount has been collected, only $6,500 for this first year that the ordinance has been in effect. There's some reasons for that. Again, we're only in year one of a five-year phase-in period, so we're only collecting a small portion of the fee that would ultimately be required when the ordinance is in full effect. The only fees that we've collected money from so far have been over-the-counter permits, one multifamily project and one commercial building over 5,000 square feet in size. Construction activity, of course, is way down, so we don't have a large number of permits that have come through the planning department that triggered the inclusionary housing fees. There's some other things to consider, too. During that first year period, we've adopted, or the county has approved, 14 discretionary permits. Each one is subject to the inclusionary housing requirement. So at some point in time, these 14 permits will come forward to either pay a fee or provide affordable housing. And I'm talking about 10 subdivisions and 4 large commercial projects. One of those commercial projects has already committed to building an affordable workforce housing unit. To sum up this annual report, no projects have been funded yet. No affordable units have been produced. And the recommendation in the annual report is to carry over the $6,500 that have been collected in the first year and combine that with the fees that will be collected in the coming year. Now, Title 29, the Affordable Housing Fund, also requires an action plan that guides how the funds will be used. And again, we have no prior year action plan, so there's no progress report to be made. And we're not recommending, with the $6,500 that were collected in the first year, we're recommending, again, that that not be paid to any housing project, but rather be carried over into the following fiscal year. And combined with the fees that we, affordable housing fees that we collect next year. Last of all, Title 29 requires that the county consider an annual fee adjustment. And the last time your board considered a fee adjustment for the Affordable Housing Funds was actually in April of this year, 2009, about 7 months ago. And the board determined that the or chose to delay the fees, delay any fee adjustment, not start the year two of the five-year phase-in period, not to make any construction cost adjustment to the affordable housing fees, but the board also indicated to staff that it would be today, this time around, be considering a fee adjustment that included going to year two of the five-year phase-in period and including construction cost increase over the past two-year period to make up for the fact that no fee adjustment was made when the board first considered this back in April of 2009. Again, when we talk about fee adjustments, there's several options open to the board. You could choose not to increase the fees, to defer or delay moving to year two of the five-year phase-in period for another year. This would give the housing industry time to recover and, again, the economy to come back to full steam. Another option would be simply to move ahead to year two of the five-year phase-in period. And what you see on the screen is the fee amounts that would go into effect when, if and when year two is of the five-year phase period is adopted. The fee would double, basically, because you're going from year one to year two of a five-year phase period. So a typical single-family house, the fee, affordable housing fee, would go from 4,000 to about 8,000. For a 10,000 square foot store, the fee would go from about 4,000 to 8,000 again. A third option is to, again, go to year two of the five-year phase-in period and include construction cost changes. It's important to consider construction cost changes because if the fees are based on a financial report that said that the county should be charging a certain amount of fees in order to be able to produce affordable housing with the dollars, the fees that are collected. And as the price of housing goes up or down, the construction costs go up or down, the fees need to be adjusted to reflect that. There's different possibilities for construction costs. You could consider adjusting a construction cost adjustment that only reflects the period of time in which the ordinance has been in effect, which is about 9 months. You could consider a construction cost adjustment that would do exactly what the ordinance says, which is look at the cost changes for a whole 1 year period. Or you can do, as the board had considered back in April, look at the construction cost changes that have happened over a 2 year period. And what you see on the screen is what the construction cost changes have been in those 3 periods. Construction costs have actually gone down. They've decreased in the last 9 months, in the last year. When you go back 2 years, then you'll be picking up the higher construction costs that were in effect that we saw a year ago. So you would be seeing, if you were to approve a construction cost adjustment for a 2 year period, you would be seeing an increase in fees of about 7%. Now on the screen is the construction cost, well, is actually the fees, affordable housing fees for year one, for the second year, and for the fifth year of the 5 year phasing period, and showing how those fees would change depending on the different construction cost adjustments that you could consider. And again, on the screen, you see those same fee adjustments for a commercial structure. So if I can put it in a nutshell, the option for adjusting the fees, the affordable housing fees, that you can consider is, first of all, the county could make no change to its affordable housing fees for this coming year, to delay any fee adjustment and delay the start of the second year of the 5 year phasing period for another year. So you would not see any fee adjustments until July of 2011. The board could consider just moving to year two of the 5 year phasing period, no construction, without any construction cost adjustment. Or the board could consider moving to year two and including construction cost adjustments. Now, before I finish my presentation, there is one other item that I want to bring up, which is that in the discussions that the county staff has had with agents and developers, particularly for larger projects that may take more than 1 year to get through the planning process, the agents would be interested in having the affordable housing requirements set at the soonest possible time point in time. The ordinance doesn't do that. The ordinance requires that the affordable housing requirement be set at the time that the project is approved, at the time that the final design has been determined, so we all know what is actually being approved, how many houses are being approved, how large the commercial area is, and the final design is what reflects the input from service agencies and from community advisory groups. In a few years, it really won't make much difference whether you apply the affordability requirement at the beginning of the process or the end of the process, because in a few years, the requirement will be the same. It will be 20% of the housing needs to be affordable. That's when the ordinance is in full effect. But while we're in this 5 year adjustment period, it can make a difference, because as you go from year to year, from year two to year three to year four, there's a significant increase in the affordable housing requirement. So for that reason, certain developers and agents are interested in seeing if the county would consider amending its inclusionary housing ordinance to require that the affordability requirement be set at the time an application is accepted rather than when the application is approved. The staff has taken a at this point in time, the staff takes a strict interpretation of the ordinance, which is to apply the affordability requirement at the time the project is approved, when the final design is approved. So the board can consider the board can decide whether or not it wants to discuss the way the staff implements the affordable housing ordinance and give staff direction today if it would choose to. But the recommended actions today are that from staff, staff recommends that the board accept the annual report that was described earlier, adopt the action plan that was described earlier, and adopt an adjustment to the Title 29 fee schedules. Now there's some alternative actions again. The board can, let me say that the resolution that is attached to the board package, there's two resolutions, one to adopt the action plan and the other to adopt a fee adjustment that would move the fee schedule to year two of the five-year period and would also include the construction cost adjustment for a two-year period. The board can choose to adopt those resolutions or to direct staff to come back with a revised resolution, and there's time available on December 8th for the staff to return with a revised with revisions to the resolution. And that concludes staff presentation.
All right, thank you. I think we have a couple questions. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the ordinance interpretation, Ted, are you suggesting that, or the reason the industry is interested in waiting or having that determination made when the application is deemed complete for processing, is that there's the potential to change because of the incremental increase over time? And that's what I assumed based on your description, but I'm curious, would it change midstream, or is it not locked in when the application is approved? We don't tend to change the rules midstream when something's in process, do we?
Well, thank you for asking. When you have a large project that might take 2 years to get through the process,
right.
While we're in our five-year period, the affordable requirement that would go on that project can increase significantly from year to year. And so for that reason, the developers want to lock in that affordability requirement up front as soon as possible when the application is first accepted. And that's the discussion we've been having. And again, staff follows the ordinance strictly, which is to say the affordability requirement will be applied when the project is approved, when we actually have the final design in front of us.
Could
we stay on the interpretation?
Sure.
I don't know. Sure. Mr. Meacham, do you have a question on the interpretation?
Yeah, in a sense, yes, I do.
Okay.
Because it goes to the issue of, let's say a project comes forward, if we set the, I don't have any problem with setting these when approved. However, if we get time extensions on these and it goes past that time frame and we're locked in and it goes past the five-year time period, I don't know that that's fair from the county standpoint either. So is there a time frame in which this interpretation is going to establish if the project doesn't move forward by a certain time, then that initial setting of the fee is off?
The ordinance doesn't have that type of flexibility that you're suggesting right now. the ordinance just takes a very simple approach that the affordable requirement is set when the project is approved. So it might inspire both staff and the applicant to try to get the project processed as quickly as possible to get a good design, well-designed project up front that will go through the process quickly so that they can get that affordability requirement set as soon as possible at the time that the project gets approved.
I understand, but if we get to a point where they've exercised their time extensions, for example, and we move past a certain length time period, that fee stays in place, and we may have had to make some pretty substantial adjustments along the way. So let's say a project comes forward year one, and say year six, all of a sudden it now starts breaking ground. Lost a lot.
That it gets approved. I think what the case you're saying is, what if it gets approved?
Let's say they're investing
tenant of TrackMan, and it doesn't actually break ground.
Exactly.
But I think what I'm hearing staff say is that once it gets approved, then that fee is due, and we would be then using that fee to construct affordable housing. Do I have that right?
The number of units required is set at the time the project's approved. The actual fee they pay is the fee schedule in place when they actually pull their construction permit.
Construction, or when the land use permit is granted?
The land use permit's approved. It says they can have so many houses on that property. And the fee schedule that they actually will use to pay the fee is the one that's in place when the construction permit is issued. And the reason for that is because the cost of affordable housing, like everything, goes up and down with the construction cost. And so if a applicant gets his subdivision map approved and doesn't actually start building houses until 5 years later, the county is still obligated to provide some affordable housing. We know that the project is required to provide affordable housing units, so they can either pay, they can either provide two affordable units on the ground, or they can pay the fee that's in place at the time that they actually build those market rate units.
So, and if I could indulge Supervisor Hill just a second, so in reading on page 6 out of the Land Use Ordinance 2212-080C2, it's established, right now the ordinance is very clear that the requirement is established at the time the land use permit or the subdivision is approved, but it's actually not paid until construction permits are brought forward. Okay.
And that's Mr. Chairman, I'm Tim McNulty, if I could just add one more coloration to that. That is, what is established is your obligation to provide inclusionary housing, not the amount of the fee that you would pay in lieu of providing that housing.
Oh.
Which I think is what Ted was trying to...
Okay.
A fee schedule.
Well, so let's go forward with this, is that, and this is really only an issue right now because we're ramping up over 5 years. We're ramping rather steeply relative to what we hope the inflator is going to be once we get past year five, right?
That's correct.
So the requirement, when you say requirement, Mr. McNulty, you're talking about the up to 20%. You're going to have to provide 20% affordable housing or the in-lieu fee in place at the time you pull construction permits? Is that what you're
saying? Yes, I believe so. The confusion comes from the title of the section, which is maybe slightly different than the text of it. The title talks about establishing the inclusionary requirement and the fee schedule. But if you read the title, it's establishing the inclusionary requirement.
Okay.
And as I understand it from Mr. Benson, what we do is we say you're required to provide X number of units. I want to provide those units. Depending on the year that you come in for your permit, that translates into a
lot of money. Okay. On this topic, if we could go to Supervisor Hill and then Ashanti.
I think that actually clarified it for me, because basically, if I get this straight from what Mr. McNulty is saying, thank you, Mr. Chair, the confusion is just because the requirement is when the application, or when the project's approved, the fee schedule is not set until
the time of construction.
Right.
Permit.
Okay. I get it now.
Mr. Sajjan?
Thank you. I want to be sure that it is what it is, because when you break ground and you start construction, you're hoping that those will sell and the cash flow will come in to pay in lieu of fee. Charge them way ahead of them. I think not knowing exactly what the economy is going to be, it's we're getting into their pockets deeper at a time where they're not generating any income for their project. But that's my understanding. But my question is, if you pull a permit today, you break ground 5 years from now, are you paying what the fee is going to be in 5 years from now, or you have a choice? If you want to pay earlier, then you pay what they are today. Or if it's a vested map, does that qualify you for the fees that were in place when you first pulled permits or got your subdivision approved?
The answer is that when you get approval, say, of a project that has five houses in it, one of those houses has to be affordable, the project will be approved with that requirement. There shall be one affordable house, or you can pay a fee. And you actually will use the fee schedule in place at the time that you pull construction permits. When we're in a, but let me finish. If it's a subdivision, you have more choices. And also, let me also say that the ordinance is flexible enough that it says that the developer, when he's pulling the fee, I mean, when he's pulling his construction permit, he wants to, if he wants to, he doesn't have to pay the fee in place or pay the fee to pull his, when he pulls his construction permit. He can defer or delay paying the fee until he actually sells the house. And again, the reason, during the five-year period, the fees and the requirements adjust or change significantly year after year, from year three to year four to year five. But once you get beyond that point, it's really not going to make much difference year to year, because your project, your five-house project, will be approved with a requirement that one of the houses be affordable. You can either make one of those houses affordable or pay the fee. And the fee is only going to go up just a little, up and down a little bit each year, depending on construction cost changes. That's after we get out of the five-year period. I wanted to finish with subdivision, because subdivisions, the subdivider can choose to pay his fee when he records his map, or he can pass the requirement, the fee requirement, on to the person who buys the lot.
A small follow-up.
Sure.
I feel like we're all over the place, but I know that we're getting where will giving me the comfort zone. I got to put myself in their shoes and see how it works. But, and I don't mean to sound negative, but take a worst-case scenario. If we allow somebody to build a house and pay at that time, but if the house doesn't sell, or as I heard you say, then allow them to sell the house, then pay us. If the house doesn't sell and goes through foreclosure, are we still entitled to that money? It goes back to the bank or to whoever loaned the money. Are we on their deed somehow say that this money belongs to us regardless if it's who buys it, how they buy it, when they buy it?
Okay, so worst case scenario, somebody pulls a building permit, defers paying the fee until the house is built, but he doesn't actually sell it.
Like we're seeing on the market today.
Okay, the requirement is still there, because when somebody chooses to defer fee payment, he has to sign a legal agreement saying, I will pay this fee when I sell this house. So if he no longer owns the house, if it goes through foreclosure, the requirement is still on the land that somebody will pay the fee at some point.
Thanks.
Let me just wonder if are we handling this in the same way that we handle road impact fees? I mean, I think that might be our touchstone, is that these fees should be handled in exactly the same way we deal with road impact fees.
They are, this, as closely as possible, we mirror the way that public facility fees and road impact fees are done. We look, once a year we come forward and consider an adjustment. Any adjustments will go into effect in July, the same time all the other fees are adjusted. or all the other increases, fee increases or decreases, go into effect, and the adjustments will, in the future, will be based solely on construction cost changes.
Right, and we're just in an extraordinary period here of ramping up the inclusionary requirement. So it's really the requirement that's adding the twist to this. But in all other manner, these fees are handled the same as our other impact fees.
That's correct.
Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, going back to your scenario of five homes, one inclusionary, they can either pay that fee when they pull the permits and they're ready to go, or they can defer that, you said, okay? When is the fee set?
The fee is set when the construction permit's issued.
Okay, and now all of a sudden construction is delayed. We're going to go through a time extension, whatever the case may be. That remains for how long?
It will not change because we will use the fee schedule in place when we issue the construction permit. If the guy wants to delay paying the fees, he signs a legal agreement saying, I will pay this much, and I will pay it when the house is sold. So the fee does not change.
Okay.
Okay, so we're clear on that point. If I see people nodding their head, I'm going to ask them a question. Other issues regarding this matter, we'll start again with Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Rolling back to the construction fee, you gave us three scenarios, a nine-month, a one-year, and a two-year. And I was just curious, are we rolling it back 2 years because of what, rather than just 1 year?
When the board first had a chance to increase the fees back in April of 2009, the board chose not to increase the fees. The board decided not to go from year one to year two.
Correct.
And it also chose not to do any construction cost adjustments. But what the board did indicate to staff is when they got a chance to look at increasing the fees the next time around today, that they would consider going to year two, and they would consider the adjustment, the fee adjustment for not just the last year, but the last 2 years, because to pick up any change in construction costs that have happened since last year when the board chose not to make any fee increases. So the board is trying, the intent was to capture the construction cost changes over the past 2 years rather than just the last year.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Let's go one more. Go in the please. Same order, and I'd like to come back, and I think I have a slightly different take than that.
I do too, thank you. But the other part of it, did you mention earlier in your report that construction costs have gone down over the last nine months?
They have gone down for the last 9 months, the last 1 year.
Okay.
If you go back 2 years, you'll see that construction costs were still going up.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Hill or Mr. Shajian, anything to add on this? Mr. McNulty?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify one thing. You asked Mr. Bench earlier about whether the program was operated in the same way as the road fee program. Under the road fee program and under the public facility fee program, which are operated under the same statute as Mr. Bench mentioned, the county doesn't allow payment of these fees at the time of occupancy. Rather, it's required to be paid at the time the building permit is pulled. And that's been an issue that we've debated back and forth with the Building Industry Association for a long time, but it's always been the way we operated it. When this program was adopted, the board decided to allow the fee to be paid at the time of occupancy of the structure rather than at the time that the building permit was pulled to construct it.
Okay, so this is one.
So I don't want to get you too far off track, but I just wanted to make sure the record was clear about at least that part of it.
Okay. My recollection is a little different than staff's on the question of the indexing. The April 9th hearing was actually a continued hearing from the 10th of March. And I listened yesterday to the discussion at the end, and specifically the motion made at the end of the hearing on March 10th. And the motion was very clear that we would go to the year two fee schedule as of July 1 of 2010, and the construction cost index would be December 08 to December 09. And that was very explicit in the motion. And unless something got changed and I didn't pick it up in the discussion of April 9th, That was clear direction to staff. The continuation was to allow them to prepare the resolution to bring back.
Okay.
So December to December is sort of close to your option 3B, actually, where October to October is I think, the equivalent of that. We were expecting to have this hearing in December, actually, of this year. We're coming a little early. So that was just, again, my reference to the record yesterday. So seeing no other lights, we'll go ahead and open it to the public. Two requests to speak, Jerry Bunin, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Jerry Bunin, Government Affairs Director for the Home Builders Association. Since I didn't hear anybody reference it, I do hope you all read the letter from the Housing Trust Fund. And I want to begin by telling you what we really appreciate. We appreciate that last year when this hearing came up that you went to a 5.5-year phase-in instead of a 4.5-year phase-in. We did appreciate that. And we also appreciated the fact that you didn't put the construction cost index increase last year. But doubling the fees today is going to wind up getting you less than zero. It's not going to get you more money in your affordable housing fund. It's not going to get you more units built. It's simply going to make it even more impossible for us to build right now. As you all know, whether you went to the economic forecast or you're getting your report from Mr. Grant, it doesn't make any sense to build right now. Our cost to build is about 25% above where the median home price is. Cannot make it make any financial sense to build. Adding to our cost isn't going to help that. Some of you know residential building permits this year are going to be 20% of an average year, 20% countywide, 40% below last year, which was the worst year on record. We're not expecting it to get any better next year. Again, adding to the cost isn't going to get more units built. So what we're hoping you will do and what we're recommending is you choose what is SAP option one, which is not increasing the fees this year, so we can have some chance that when things recover, we don't have too many additional cost increases to worry about. I'm going to jump into the latter issue as well, the interpretation issue. I'm not sure I can do this in a minute on the fly, but just as a general rule, Supervisor Meacham, I don't think the majority of builders are going to pull a construction permit unless they're planning to build immediately. It usually is like a precursor to going to break ground the next day. There will be exceptions. We've had exceptions in this current recession, but they're going to be pretty rare. Mr. McNulty is right. We have had an ongoing disagreement about when you can legally collect your fees. I think if you go read AB 1600, it will say that you collect those fees at certificate of occupancy except. And you've had some very creative staff members' interpretation of what that except applies to. And we've chosen not to go to court and fight you over this, and we're probably still not going to fight you over it. But I would say that what you've got here is the same thing you've got in that interpretation of it. And the last thing I just want to make sure, if you give me a few extra seconds, is the issue we have on the when you apply the phase into the project. Let's just say you have a 100-unit project, and it's ready for hearing in January, and it doesn't get approved to July 5. So you approved a 100-unit project, but now the inclusionary requirement is going to go up by 4 more units, and you're either going to build those 4 units and 4 density bonus units, or you're going to pay almost $500,000 in lieu fees. So there's a major impact in the project because of that transition. Thank you for the
extra time. Thank you, Mr.
Bunin. Listening.
Sure. Dr. Height, followed by John Knight.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos Rural Community Workshop. Pay a fee or provide affordable housing. Pay a fee or provide affordable housing. What's wrong with this picture? Well, providing affordable housing when the units are going up is immediate. What does paying the fee do? Are you going to be putting units up at the same time? No. building affordable housing is immediate, paying a fee is putting money into a bureaucracy. And I've got to hope that that money actually goes to providing an important need. You've got people commuting from Santa Maria. You've got people riding the bus system who work in the hotels and motels and the restaurants and can't afford to live here. It's a terrible burden for people who can't afford to live here. Are you going to do what you did with transportation and hire magic consultants to tell you what housing of the future is in San Luis Obispo like you did in transportation? Like I said, affordable housing, building it is immediate, paying a fee isn't. If this board or any past board all the way back to 2003 had ever just lifted a finger and sent your council and your administrator down to the law library to look at the updates of the ADA and the Unruh Civil Rights Act, that is a Fair Housing, Fair Employment Act, you would know that there is no precedence for paying a fee and I get to be exclusive. Just put a billboard up on your developments. We pay the fee. No senior, unsightly senior or disabled people need to apply. We pay the fee. We pay the fee. Whites only. We are a gated community. We pay the fee. Paying the fee allows for non-inclusionary housing. Paying the fee allows for discrimination. Paying the fee allows for segregation and a gated community. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And I've spoken to this point before. I want you to think about, as tomorrow is Veterans Day and I missed my chance to speak in public comment, I want you to think about that veterans, people who are in military service, don't always live on an airbase. They need affordable housing to move into. And historically, there's been a lot of discrimination against military families. So think about the reality of meeting your obligation and allowing people to just live here, work here, have families here, and prosper here. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. Knight.
Good morning. Thank you, John Knight with J. Knight Consulting. The issue I want to talk about is actually the ramp-up period, and I brought this to staff, and I appreciate staff bringing this forward, and Jerry Bunin touched on it briefly as well. It's a confusing issue, and I've spent a lot of time looking at it, and you know, 5 years from now, we won't worry about it because we'll be at the full ramp-up. It goes 4%, 8%, 12%, 16%, 20%. Right now, we're in year one, and the intent of the ramp-up was to soften the financial blow to developers and home builders. And the question at hand is when you determine what year that you're in. A reasonable way to approach that is in the first year. But in the year that you submit. In the year that you submit, get your application complete, that's when you should know what your requirement is and what year you're in. The way staff has interpreted it is that you should be determined at the time it's approved. On large projects, and this issue primarily affects large projects, on large projects it's potentially a multi-year period to get your project approved. By the time you start and the time you're finished, you may be in a different ramp-up year. And the reason that's important is because for larger projects, you have an opportunity to get the inclusionary housing units, get those units built on site, get your density bonus approved, included as part of the project. So using a simple example of 100, let's say you started today, you have 100 units, that's your base, you add the 4 units, you get a density bonus, so you get a total of 104 units. All your environmental documents, all your traffic, your air quality, everything else needs to be based on that 104 units. The problem comes in the process when, because of the timing, maybe you didn't make the 4%, maybe it got approved in the next year and it went 8%, so your affordable housing requirement is doubled. Well, we'd like to be able to build those units on site, but we no longer can because all our designs, environmental documents, and everything else has been based on the smaller amount, the 104 units. It's a moving target. It's difficult to, at the time of design, determine which process, which percentage you're going to be in. It's a more fair and appropriate way to determine it as part of the application submittal process. When the application's complete, let people know what their requirements are. They can request their density bonus and make the commitments, hopefully, to build those units on site. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Knight. That was our last request to speak, so we'll close it to the public and bring it back for discussion at the board. I would suggest we take this in two parts. One is the determination of what fee structure we're going to set for our next fiscal year. Again, any decision we make today goes into effect July 1 of 2010, and then talk about the interpretation question. We'll start with Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you. We are in a tough economic climate right now, and granted, building hasn't occurred at the same rate that it has in past years, and it was just pointed out recently that it probably won't recover if we have another round of foreclosures flooding the market, which some people are anticipating will happen. But at the same time, if we don't get our inclusionary ordinance implemented to its fullest, then we're never going to reach that level of 20%. And I want to remind my colleagues who were here during that discussion and my two new colleagues who weren't. Originally, when we adopted this, there was a discussion about implementing it immediately or over a four-year period, and the building industry asked for a six-year implementation period, and we compromised, thanks to Supervisor Gibson, I think, suggested that we make it a five-year implementation period, and that's what we settled on. And my inclination is to continue that progression. And even a year ago, we extended it to 18 months instead of a 12-month ramp-up. We should be in year two now. We're only in year one. And so I think it makes sense to do that. And I want to point out, as Mr. Knight said, that there is a bonus, a density bonus that's granted with this inclusionary housing ordinance, and that the builder does get additional units in order to provide the affordable housing in the project. And we also gave builders several options to meet that affordability requirement. So I think we've really bent over backwards to make this thing work. And I think it's time, despite the tough economy, that we continue to move that progression forward. We do have a five-year implementation period, and I think we should move forward to year two. And as far as the construction cost increase, I think, as Supervisor Gibson pointed out in listening to the original motion, that option 3B would make sense and meet that requirement. And as far as interpretation goes, I think until we get it fully implemented, as Mr. Knight pointed out, there's some question as to what the builder actually has to anticipate. And it could go from one tier to the next, so to speak, during the course of the approval process or moving it through the advisory committees and the planning commission, et cetera. And so I would be willing to agree until we get to full implementation at 20% that when the application is presented and deemed complete for processing, that we set the inclusionary requirement at that time so they can evaluate it through the environmental review process and all the rest. So I think that makes good sense from my perspective, unless I hear differently.
Put on the dais, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've spent a lot of time talking with Mr. Bunin the last couple of years about these programs and how they work best. And the reason why I would not support going to year two right now is I think that they do work. These programs have worked, and we've seen them work throughout the state and throughout the country, but they tend to work really only when there is a healthy housing market, whether it be both in building and in sales, and that's not where we're at right now. And I think that, and it's not being overly sensitive to the economy. I think that's valuable and sometimes it can be detrimental too. I'm not sure where we're at in terms of that market. You know, when things do pick up, we might have a better sense of what that's going to be. So I'm okay with basically recommendation number one on the fee adjustment and delaying it for another year. Because quite frankly, we're not collecting anything because nothing's going on. And at this point, we have heard from not just the building industry, but also from people, as Mr. Bunin referenced, Mr. Rio, who is certainly an advocate for affordable housing, and also an advocate for these sorts of programs. So I'm willing to go with postponing the fee increases for another year.
Mr. Shajian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the market rules, no matter what we do, doesn't mean that we're going to achieve our goals, because our goals is based on if there is any action in the on the market or not. And to say that we have seen the bottom of it, I don't think that is the case. I think there are more foreclosures to be heard about. It just happened to be in the pipeline. They haven't hit that bottom line yet. So for all the reasons that we have been hearing on the economic symposium that some of us attended last week, and some of us who are more active on the market know exactly what's going on, and especially in the housing market, I don't think that raising the fees is the proper thing to do at this time. I will not support any fees increase as we speak. Time will tell. We'll have another shot at it next year, and we'll see where we go from it. But just raising the fee doesn't mean that we're going to receive more money simply because there is no action.
Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My two colleagues to the far side did pretty much wrapped up what I was going to suggest, but if you listen to the economic forecast and you've heard all of the indicators out there, we're going to be in a very kind of a slow recovery. I think it's going to take us some time. So to suggest that even though we're in a tough time, we still need to implement this, I think this is just kind of adding more weight to the difficulty of trying to get something accomplished. So I can't support trying to add more fees and trying to put this all in place to reach that 20% within the next 5 years without recognizing the fact that we have a slow recovery in this economy. And I think we need to be able to adjust with that. So I can't support that Patterson's suggestion. I would support option one, and that would to make no changes to these fees.
Let me go to County Council and take another round of discussion here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I don't know if the board is interested in acting upon Supervisor Patterson's suggestion about when we would interpret the date for setting the fee, but I wanted to caution you that, as you can see on page C26 of your staff report, the land use ordinance language itself actually addresses the issue of when the inclusionary requirement is established, and it doesn't talk about application completeness. Instead, it talks about actual approval of either a ministerial or discretionary permit. So I think if you want to do what has been suggested, it may require that we come back to you with an amendment to the ordinance.
Thank you. Now, I was going to pick up on that because I do think the black and white is very clear there. But at the same time, I don't think the effect is quite as draconian as the building industry might think. At the point of approval, the fee doesn't have to be paid, but the requirement is set. So speaking to Mr. Knight's concern, 100-unit project with 4 density bonus units, which would be the affordable units, if approved under the 4% reality, would stick. That would be, they're going to build those units, that would be what, no matter when they build,
that's right.
It would not be the full 20% because they got approved under the deal.
Okay. That's right. I think we can establish certainty. It just won't come at the time of approval. It's going to come at the time. I'm sorry. It won't come at the time of permit application completeness, but rather the time of permit approval.
Right. And I would submit that while it's not explicit here, if instead a project was going to pay the in-lieu fee, that it would be similarly proportional. That the requirement is set. That doesn't mean that they would be subject to the fee going up in its increments as it heads toward the full $20,000. Now, I think they could be subject to the inflator, but not the thing. And I think that that's a calculable. I mean, we just need to maintain the chart here as we go along for as we're through and going through the ramp up period. We just need to know what the base fee and apply an inflation index to it, which presumably over the course of 3 or 4 or 5 years isn't going to be difficult to track. Slight furrow in Mr. Bench's brow, but I hope that's clear.
No, and thank you. If I understand the direction of the conversation here, both the affordability requirement and the fee schedule should be set at the same time. So if somebody has a five-unit project and they're required to, it's approved with one of the units being affordable or paying a fee on the date of approval or the date the application is accepted, whichever it is, the number of housing units is set and the fee schedule is set at the same time. Is that how
that would be my that would be my understanding as okay. of the date of approval.
Just point of clarification on that, then. It was my understanding, and the reason the interpretation was asked for by the board is that that is not how it was applied, how it was just described. And the way John Knight described the scenario is we have these incremental increases over time, that couldn't happen then. It wouldn't roll over into the next tier because it would have been set at the time of the application approval.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
I think that it's correct that it, well, if you read the language of the ordinance, it's supposed to be set at the time the approval is granted. So to use Mr. Bench's example, if your obligation is to provide one inclusionary housing unit based on the number of units that you propose to build, that is established at the time of your approval. And if you come in for a subdivision map, that's established at the time you get your discretionary approval from either the Planning Commission or the Board. If you come in for an over-the-counter type permit, that's established when you submit your application materials and they're complete.
Okay, so there's no question about a changing in process then?
It shouldn't,
okay.
Based on what we have in our ordinance.
Okay. Again, black and white in the ordinance.
I know, but the people in the industry are having a problem with that.
Right.
I'm not sure that is how staff was interpreting it.
Cami Griffin, County Planning Staff. That is how staff was interpreting it. I think that the description that Mr. Knight provided you is a description that happens prior to approval. So let's say you're in year one, you've designed a project that is five units with one affordable, but your approval occurs in year two, which applies then. If you set it at the time of approval, suddenly you're now having to provide an additional unit or something different than you came in at year one. So it's those odd circumstances where you might carry through a year. Now, I would hope that as staff reviewing the project, we would recognize, oops, this looks like it's not going to get approved within year one. We need to go back and work with the applicant and assure that at the time of approval, you have a compliant project that meets whatever is in place at the time of approval.
So it could change during the process then.
From acceptance to approval. But again, the LUO is very clear that it's approval. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I ask Mr. Bunin a question, if I could? At what point during this process do you establish the construction financing?
Chair Bunin, Governor Affairs Director, Home Builders Association. You're doing it when you are initially proposing the project, and you're solidifying it when you're getting approval.
Okay.
In terms of construction financing. I don't want to belabor this, but, you know, there's a difference between what you get approved on June 30th and what you get approved on July 1. And that's the issue, is you spent all of your time on one project, and because it gets delayed for whatever reasons, it changes the equation.
Thank you. Now, let me just ask staff, it would seem we have discretion to waive fees as we do for any other project. We do that on road fees, and so we could, if there are circumstances beyond the control of the applicant, I think we're in a position to waive fees or adjust them as we need to. So I think that's covered. Back to the other issue, you know, the whole question of phasing this in over 5 years was the board's response to the difficulty of the environment, and we heard testimony at the building environment, and we heard testimony at the time that we were approving this, that this was how the building industry wanted to respond. I'm concerned that we need to take a long-term view here, and by year five, we need to be at a point to have an inclusionary housing ordinance operating, and the in-lieu fees operating as they're supposed to be. I understand it. It's a burden, and I understand that the home builders are not fond of inclusionary housing ordinances. But Mr. Bunin testified at the point in December of 08 when we approved this ordinance that he thought this one was as fair and workable an ordinance as there is in this state. That we also very much spoke in support of the phasing program. So I'm concerned that if we don't take the incremental step to add, you know, something less than $4,000 to the permit fees here, that we've lost our long-term vision. And again, the unanimously passed motion of the 10th indicated that that was going to be our track. Again, going back to that motion, the motion was quite clear that the construction cost inflator would be December 08 to December 09, and in this case, October 08 to October 09 in option 3B is the one that I think is the one we should support. And I wouldn't be able to support no increase in fee unless we have some clear sense that in year three that we're going to get back to year three, and I don't think that we're going to hear a lot of favorable testimony if we were to then triple fees. So I think we need to stay on track. I understand that it imposes some extra burden, but I wouldn't agree that it is the determining factor in terms of whether somebody builds a house or not. So with that, I had Supervisor Shajan on the next slide. And,
thank you, Mr. Chair. To move this along, and you want it in two separate parts, my first part, dealing with fees, I'll move that we'll make no fee increases in response to the economic downturn.
Second. Any discussion on that motion? Mr. Hill.
Yeah, I'm going to support the motion, but I did want to address some of the things that you brought up, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I don't think that, you know, I understand too, and I don't think that this in and of itself, the ordinance is a burden or an obstacle that's going to determine whether people go ahead with building projects, and so I don't accept that, and I do think that, but I don't also think that it's a either or on the long-term vision of this working. There's not much going on. There's not going to be much going on. We're not exactly sure. This is not the only method there is to try to collect money or to get units built. So that's basically my concern about you know, that we could hold off on the fees for a year. And you know, I'm and we'll get to that, I guess, in the second motion, but I'm fine with how it's being applied. But I do think...
So let me just ask the intent of your support and to the motion maker in the second. Is it your thought that we're simply going to delay the implementation of this another year, or are we going to jump back to year three when we consider this a year from now?
Delay the implementation.
By a year.
Yes. And then we come back to it then.
That's what my thinking is on the regard to the second.
Okay. I won't be supporting the motion. I certainly appreciate your position on this, and again, I think it's just simply a difference of opinion on how we need to move forward on that. Any other discussion on the motion? Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, will not support the motion simply because it's taken us so long to get this inclusionary housing ordinance in place that we've lost a lot of opportunity, and when the market rebounds, which it inevitably will, if we continue to delay the implementation of this, we'll be that much further behind in reaching the goal of providing affordable housing. And again, I don't think it's an excessive burden to the industry, simply because they are given additional units to provide this opportunity, and so they can make it up. These inclusionary ordinances have been extremely effective throughout the state and the country and throughout the county. And the county, I feel, has just not taken advantage of this opportunity and delaying it another year. continues to put us further behind in achieving our goal of providing affordable housing for the residents of San Luis Obispo County.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll take a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Asajjian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
No.
Mr. Gibson?
No. And you had another motion in mind, Mr. Asajjian, on the interpretation?
I'll give outer supervisor the opportunity to...
I think, to me, the applications, as we're doing it and as was clarified, I think, by staff, is as we should keep it.
All right.
And so that would be my motion.
Why don't we do staff's recommendation on that is your motion? Do we have a second?
Second.
We'll take that on a voice vote, seeing no further discussion. All those in favor, aye?
Aye.
Opposed? None. All right. At this point, thank you, staff. Is any questions from staff following up on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, so as I understand it, the board adopted the resolution approving the annual action plan that was on page C-221 of your staff report.
Right. Yes.
But it did not adopt the resolution on page C-225, which would have increased the existing fees.
All right. Does staff want to trail that to the afternoon?
So, well, we'd like to continue to December 8th.
Okay.
So we can prepare the resolution properly. We've reserved time.
Okay. And can we simply ask for
the tentative motion then? Or?
Yes. What I was going to suggest was it probably would be worthwhile to have a resolution which reflects your board's action of not increasing any of the fees,
okay,
rather than just having that be a voice vote in the minutes.
Okay.
It'd be better, I think, if we had a resolution. So if we could either come back at the end of today or at the date suggested with an amended version of the resolution that's on page C-225, that would be best. We could probably try to fit it in later on today if you want.
So, again, we had the roll call vote, which was on the matter of fees. And we'll take that as a tentative motion with a trail to 1:30. Is that sufficient time to produce that?
Yeah, I think we can do it. It's just a simple matter of adjusting one of the paragraphs in the existing resolution.
So if the motion maker and the second are comfortable with that modification to the roll call motion, the first motion.
Right.
The voice vote was on the matter of interpretation, which is acceptable?
That's acceptable.
All right, thank you. Okay, with that, we will take a break and plan to convene at about 10 minutes after 11. And we're clerk heats us up. We're ready. Thank you, ma'am. We are back, and Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our next item, please.
Item D1 is consideration of alternate work schedules in order to help greenhouse gas emissions per AB 32 legislation.
Thank you. Mr. Grant.
Good morning. Jim Grant, County Administrator. A little history. In September of 2006, Governor Schwarzenegger signed into law AB 32. This is known as the Global Warming Solutions Act. This legislation required that greenhouse gas emissions to be reduced by to 1999 levels by the year 2020, which is about a 25% reduction for us. One approach that we're working on and bringing to you today is to reduce emissions by reducing the commuting to and from work by county employees. Dan Buckshaw has headed up a committee that was comprised of the auditor, planning, human resources, general services agency, that was created to look at and develop alternative work schedule options for you. Today, Dan's going to present the specifics of the program and ask you to consider directing staff to create a countywide flexible work schedule and telecommute policy.
All right. Dan? Thank you, sir. Mr. Buckshot.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, if we could pull up the PowerPoint, please. And since Mr. Grant handled the overview, we will roll through the background and just jump right into it. The impact to us as an organization, I do want to emphasize this is the county as an organization, not as an entire region, is that two-thirds of the greenhouse gas emissions are related to the employees' commute to and from work. And one of the goals is to drive down these greenhouse gas emissions, pun intended there. That being said, we're looking at doing a number of different things as an organization. The Planning and Building Department is leading an effort to create a climate action plan. A couple weeks ago, we spoke about AB 811. Your board directed staff to further pursue a program which allows for energy retrofits and solar installations, allows for additional financing. And then you can see some of the other programs here that fit in the various components that fit into the overall plans and activities that are occurring. What we're here to talk about today, however, is alternative work schedules, which is another piece of the puzzle. And the goal simply is to reduce the amount of employee commuting. Two options for consideration you can see here is telecommuting as well as flexible work schedules. And as noted on the slide here, we're not pioneering new ground. This is these are policies that have been utilized in both public and private sectors for at least two decades, if not longer in some cases. With respect to telecommuting, generally employees would work from home or elsewhere. I think most likely it would be from home. Not available to all employees. Not all jobs are suited towards this type of arrangement. Some need to be here in order to serve the public or other types of frontline duties that don't fit this type of model. So that being the case, it would be up to the department to decide which position and which individuals would work this type of arrangement. And if your board directed staff to create a countywide policy, we would base it upon the policy that was created by Planning and Building. It's been used for about 3 years, has been viewed as quite successful, and we would tweak that a bit in order to accommodate a few additional changes, but nothing too significant. With respect to the flexible work schedule, a few different options that could be considered. First would be the 9x80 schedule, where individuals would work 9-hour days, essentially not work every other Friday, or 4x10, where individuals would work a 10-hour day and not work each Friday. Another option is to allow flexibility where both schedules could be available to departments and they would implement on a case-by-case basis depending upon their operations and the needs of their customers and the makeup of their workforce. One of the key decisions that's before your board today is whether or not to allow that flexibility on a department basis or if you want to set a specific schedule that would be followed, meaning that all employees would work a 4x10 or a 9x80 schedule, and another option along those lines would be, does the county close for business on one of those days? For instance, a 4x10 arrangement could be that the county's closed for business, say a Friday or a Monday or any day, it doesn't really matter, but Friday would likely be the most common approach. The open hours would be extended on Monday through Thursdays to the public so that the amount of service available to the public is not lessened. The open time frame is the same. Or the other option, as I mentioned, is to create a flexible schedule. So that's the key question that we'll be putting before your board today. And with that, the recommendations are to create a telecommute policy countywide as well as a flexible work schedule. And the last point is regarding to the question that I just noted, is to allow for departmental discretion, not create a specific rigid schedule, if you will. And this is based upon extensive feedback from departments. These policies or approaches that are brought before your board today were vetted very thoroughly with all departments, and the overwhelming feedback was to allow that flexibility so that the impact of departments, customers, and our customers as a collective organization is not overly negatively impacted, and that allows flexibility for employees as well. Next steps, if your board were to support staff's recommendations, are to create the policies, work with the employee associations as necessary to implement. Most of the MOUs already allow for this sort of thing. It's not anything new, but just to make sure nothing's missed, we'll revisit this with all the employee associations. Some modifications be required to the payroll system to allow for the 9x80 schedule. And then once that's done, we would update the information and roll it out within the next couple of months. Something that we will do is try to track the data in terms of what type of impact does this really make. Rideshare did a rather comprehensive evaluation and survey, I'm not sure how long ago, within the last year, I believe. That's where the information came about, two-thirds of the greenhouse gas being related to commuting. So we would do that survey maybe a year from now, and then again a year or two after that to evaluate what commute patterns look like to see if this has really had the intended effects that we're looking for. And then, as Mr. Grant noted, just special thanks to all those involved in this committee. It really was a cross-functional approach to this, driven by multiple departments. And that's it.
Okay.
And thank you, Mr. Buckshaw. I do see the aforementioned four members of our esteemed department heads in the audience. I didn't know, I'd certainly offer them the chance to offer additional comments if they had any. Do appreciate your help in thinking about this. We do have a few lights on. Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, a couple of questions. One, are there some, if we were to go in the direction of giving a directive, and I do like the 980, and I've looked at it, at where it's implemented, and it seems that not only does that address some of the greenhouse gas emission issues that we're really specifically focused on, but I think even for productivity reasons, it has been successful in a lot of workplaces. But are there I guess the one that comes to mind might be the sheriff's department. Are there some departments where such a schedule just wouldn't work?
Yeah, and that's a good question. This is really geared towards the workers that currently work a standard 8-to-5 schedule, Monday through Friday. Sheriff's Department, as well as, I believe, probation, have set work schedules, as do some other departments where this wouldn't apply.
So it wouldn't apply, okay.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to supersede that.
And thanks for that clarification. The other question is if we just sort of go in the direction of not giving any direction, other than just sort of allowing flexibility, what do we...
It's an interesting direction.
That's one of the directions, which is, I guess, sort of blow on it. What expectations do we have that this will be implemented? You know, I understand the desire for departments to have the flexibility and to want to make the calls for each department, but is that sort of a way of saying, other than two or three departments, we're not going to see people go to this?
I would suspect it'll be more than that. We've reviewed this at multiple department head meetings, also did a survey, and the overwhelming response was that employees are supportive of this and are very interested in this type of program.
Okay, and so then if that's the case, the reason that we've heard from our department heads that they want just the flexibility rather than direction would be?
It's the impact on operations. Not all positions will be able to do this. There'll be some cases where simply can't accommodate. And then also, one of the feedback that other areas that have done this, other organizations, the feedback's overwhelmingly been very positive. But one of the negatives is that those with child care sometimes have difficulty supporting this type of arrangement. So by not mandating, allowing it to be more flexible, should do a better job of accommodating everybody as opposed to maybe excluding certain groups.
I think one of the things we can do, though, if the board decides to allow this to go forward, is to bring back an informational item in a few months once we've got this down a little bit better. We can bring something back to your board that says, here's what the program really looks like.
Okay. Great.
Mr. Shadjan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Prior for us to make giving you a direction, has this begun, and I haven't heard from department heads or any employee association for some input to say that, yes, we agree with one or two of the recommendations. Have we gone to them to say what else is out there, or what are your thinking, and what you would recommend, or how can we work together to bring something forward that's more creative and more acceptable? That's one question I have. If you care to answer that, then I'll have another one.
Yes, to all of the above.
Okay. Thank you. And then when we talk about the 980 or any other formulas we have, looking at this year's Christmas and New Year, I believe it's happening on Sunday?
Christmas on Friday this year.
On Friday. And so what day do they get off?
In that hypothetical example, I don't think this would be implemented by, certainly not before the beginning of the new year, but in that example, an individual, one of the things we'd be working out in detail, let's say the Friday that you're scheduled to have off is a holiday, one of two things that most other organizations have done. You're allowed to take the holiday the day prior, or you could bank that 8-hour day and use it.
They don't lose the holidays.
Right.
So I'm thinking when it comes to cost saving, if there is a day that they want to take another voluntarily day off that will make a little more out of a long weekend, that is available for our folks that work for us.
Those options would still exist. This would not impact the voluntary time off program. County employees are still encouraged to utilize that program. We would not be trying to limit that in any way by implementing this.
Okay.
Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really thrilled to see this come forward. I know when we talked about this at the very beginning, I was really interested in trying to pursue this. And I guess I take a little bit of a different approach to it as opposed to the AB 32. I'm not concerned about the emissions issue, but I'm more looking at this from a standpoint of a morale issue and a cost issue. We've been asking folks to give up a lot in a lot of cases. I think this gives them an opportunity to get back a little something else by having that three-day time period. I like the 980. I really like that type of a schedule. And it reduces their cost as far as going back and forth to work on that particular day and to be able to get other things done. So I think I look at this as more of how can we be more creative in trying to help our employees, and how can we put together something that's palatable to them. And everything that I've been hearing back is everybody's very receptive to looking at this. And as Dan mentioned, this isn't anything new. My wife does this every single day. She works out of our home, and she works across the country. So if we can work across the country, I'm sure we can work across the county and find ways that we can be as productive, and I think in some cases even more so, because you have the opportunity to work undisturbed in some cases. So I'm very supportive of moving forward with this.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm quite supportive of it, and know other people that work under these various programs and are quite productive and quite thankful that they have the opportunity, and I'm glad to see the county moving forward with it. A couple of questions you'll be bringing, should we direct you to pursue this, as requested, you'd be bringing the specific policies back to this board for approval?
If you'd like us to do so, we certainly can. We
okay,
left that
but then,
open.
Yeah, I think you mentioned a couple of months you could roll it out.
Yeah.
One question I have is you've really, a couple of things. At this juncture, I think that we should try to implement it with minimal impact to the public we serve. So at some point in time, if the budget keeps becoming more and more difficult, or as it becomes more and more difficult to balance, we may have to do some things that will adversely impact service to the public. But I don't think that we're ready for that with this program. I think this program should have minimal impacts on service to the public as it's described in the staff report. The other thing that you mentioned, Mr. Buckshy, is that it would be to the discretion of the department head as to whether or not an individual would be able to implement one of these or utilize one of these programs. And I'm wondering if there is a question or dispute, if you will, as to whether or not an employee be allowed to do it, if there's some way of, or will be in the policy, some way of reconciling that, or if it's solely at the discretion of the department head.
Based upon the way the current telecommute policy is structured that planning has had in place, and we would likely use that as a foundation, is that it's the department's directive. It is not an employee right to this type of schedule, and that it really is, it must accommodate the operations of the organization. That's the big driver for why the departmental discretion has been requested from departments.
Thank you.
Mr. Meacham touched on a couple of thoughts that I was having as well, as we have a primary goal of, we have a stated goal of greenhouse gas reductions. That's a noble one. But I think there are other goals in terms of employee morale. Mr. Meacham referenced cost. I think another way of looking at that is productivity. And that's a theme that I'd like to sound as we go forward into some of these future budget discussions. We need to be looking at the productivity of the organization. I think if we take those as two other goals, we have three main goals. I think they're not at all incompatible. I think we can see advances on all of those fronts, but I think we should track all of those fronts at the same time. And so, we do have surveys of employee morale. That's a good thing. Mr. Buckshire remarked about, tracking vehicle miles traveled. That's clearly something we should do, because we can get credit for that in terms of our AB 32 compliance. But I think we also need to start thinking about how we track productivity and making sure that this doesn't get in the way of productivity. And again, I don't see any natural reason why it should, but I think we ought to just keep aware of that. I do have a couple of requests to speak. Mr. Greening, followed by Kimberly Daniels.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I'm glad you're having this discussion. I think if it is popular with the employees and if it boosts the morale, then it's definitely a direction to pursue. The question of whether it would be mostly implemented in places where people don't have to be there simultaneously, so that different people can implement it on different days, versus a mandatory situation where the county, certain departments are simply out of business on certain days. If it should get to the latter due to economic circumstances or something else, I would suggest that actually from the standpoint of the public, 10-4 would work better than 9-80, simply because if some Fridays a department was out of business, the public would just get endlessly confused. Let's see, is this one of those Fridays? And it would be as if you were losing all the Fridays. That said, an important issue, the longer the workday becomes on the days when people do work, we need to be sure to preserve all commute options for the people working so that they're not forced into automobiles. And that means we have one more reason to maintain the full span of service that we have with public transit. I'm very thankful that last week, as part of the RTA board, you chose not to implement the possibility of chopping 2 hours off the weekday span of service. That was dangled over the abyss. It will probably be dangled over the abyss again. The unmet needs posters talk about not only telling what you need, but the possibility of service cuts. I trust and hope that the SDA money is on its way back. But if you're going to be talking about implementing this, make sure that the full range of commute options remains, or we'll be moving backwards on greenhouse gas emissions. Keep the span of service along with the flexibility of hours people work. Keep the flexibility of ways people can get here. Thank you. More and more organizations are doing this, not just the county, and people going to those organizations use public transit and need to be able to continue doing so, even where they go to 312s, which some organizations are doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Daniels.
Good morning, Board. Kimberly Daniels, General Manager of the County Employees Association. I'd like to start out by saying we totally support flexible working schedules, regardless of how the hours are set or if it's telecommuting. I would urge your board to please allow departments the flexibility to determine departmentally what their needs are. With some of the really significantly large departments, you may find that 980s work well for one aspect of their department and 410s work better somewhere else. With the budget the way it is, and at least another year of tough economic times, we've had employees come forward that are working in positions where they've been able to, as a group, work out where 410s worked best for them so that they had a consistent schedule that they were able to plan on when they were going to be at work instead of shifting within a pay period. And that schedule and ability to set a 410 allowed for, with a department that is shorthanded and no ability to hire additional staff, to cover what the needs of the department are in that particular unit and give the employees consistency. So the employees on the line are the best judge of what will work and what won't, and working with their departments and the ability to sell, whether it's a 980 or a 410, to the department so that the needs of the taxpayers that we serve are being met, the needs of the department are being met, the employees are in an environment where they can count on what their schedule is, they're getting sufficient rest, and having some consistency, I think, is really, really important. And I don't know if your board is aware, but in the mid to late 90s, the Department of Social Services actually had 980s available to staff. It worked really well. There was some changes within the leadership, and changes were made in the ability to work 980s. Many of our departments have flexible schedules right now because it's what works best for the needs of the department,
We end up a lot of times simply doing a side letter to exempt a group that we represent from what is the regular work schedule and any waiver of overtime, things of that nature, because it's what works best for the department, and the employees that work for the county truly are committed to providing the absolute best level of service that they can. They take an immense amount of pride in the jobs they do. So we totally support anything that doesn't cost and increases morale and works out better for the employees, the departments, and the public we serve. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Daniels. We'll, seeing no other requests to speak, close it to the public. Bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
I have a question, if I could, and maybe Mr. Seabock could answer this one. In terms of if we were to go with the flexibility of 410s or the 980, does that complicate the payroll structure by having both?
Jerry Seabock, Auditor Controller. Mr. Meacham, not really. It's the 410 is already available and being used. The 980 is the one that does create a little bit of complication. So there is, we believe there has to be some meet and confer. There has to be maybe one or two ordinance changes, which your board can do, which shouldn't be a big deal, we don't think. But in the system, in order to comply with fair labor standards, we have to change the work week. Our work week technically starts on Sunday and runs to Saturday. Most people work in the middle of that, Monday through Friday. the way that actually the Department of Labor recommends to do a 980 is to change your work week to start in the middle of the day on Friday, so that you go from noon Friday to the following Friday noon. So that when you work on a Friday, half of your hours is 4 hours goes to the prior week and 4 hours goes to the next week. It sounds like just a total gimmick, which is exactly what it is, but believe it or not, the federal government recommends that if you want to do 980. So that's the complication. It isn't the having the 410s or the 980. It's the 980 is the one that's the complication. And there's an awkward transition period. The first time you move into the 980, in our case, we could have people that worked Monday through Friday, and the first time we do this, all of a sudden they have a 36-hour week, and they've been short 4 hours of pay. And they make that up 25 years from now when they finally retire and they get back that 4 hours.
Sounds like the state's
so I'm just guessing. I'm just guessing that could be a problem for some people with that.
The other question I have that might be for Mr. Grant, in terms of the either the 410 or the 980, are we talking an either or are we talking the flexibility of both? Because it appears to me that if we did the 410s across the board, we'd be closed one day with everybody, and that's not what the intent would be. I would think that the 980 allows for coverage still to remain, but...
Yes, Jim Grant, my preference right now is the 980s because we do remain open Monday through Friday, and so the public is served. The option with the department, though, does allow for a 410 in some instances, but that's sort of what we want to go back and work out, is that I'm not, at this point, supportive of actually closing down on a Friday at this point in time. So we've got some details to work out, and I'm sure that working with the auditor, we can work out those other details with the system that we have.
Supervisor, actually, with a 410, you can mandate that and some counties, I believe, have done that. They call it Green Friday or something. Fridays are closed.
That's
well, everybody's 410. But you can have a 410 that rotates. So some people work Tuesday through Friday, and some work Monday through Thursday, and some, so you can have the offices remain open even though 410 is your typical schedule. I think the key decision that the committee needs you, the really key decision is, do you want to have a shutdown day, or not. And if you don't, then you kind of get into, you better let the departments work it out as best they can, because they've got to juggle things to try to make sure there's still coverage of every day. It's very simple if you said, well, Friday is done. Everybody's going to have to work around that. We're shut down Friday. That becomes, the dominoes fall a different direction.
And I know there was a minority opinion within the committee that thought that in terms of the goal of at least reducing greenhouse gases and taking to that the operation of the plant and all the other things that would be reduced, not eliminated, when we shut down for a day, that that really was the best way to accomplish that goal. And I think this discussion is useful, and it brings up other goals that we have. And quite clearly, our admin office is not recommending at this point that we shut any of the 5 days of the business week, and also the Saturdays and Sundays that some of our services are provided as well. But I guess it's my observation that whether it's 980 or 410, I think we leave it to our departments who understand their missions best within the parameters of being open Monday through Friday to craft whatever works best for their mission and their employees.
We put a little English on it and say we really want them to pursue it and let them pursue it as... I mean, I think it's a good thing, and I think for the reasons, and I agree with you. I think the closing is probably a budgetary thing separate from right. what we're looking at, which are greenhouse gas emission reductions, I think better productivity and better morale. I think those are three good goals that can be accomplished if we... encourage our departments to offer these schedules as they see fit for their employees. Yeah, that's a motion.
Okay. Which gets us going. Which widely construed sounds like staff's recommendation. With the rest of the details inherent in that. And seeing no other yes,
can I
ma'am.
Ask a question?
Okay.
Sorry, you guys blindsided me.
That's going to go down in the clerk. When the clerks meet, you know, next week, the clerks meet, they tell stories of motions made, you know, and
really?
The crazy kind of motions that get
so
made.
Are you accepting all three options, or are you actually choosing one of the options?
We are headed option three, I guess, in the
okay.
staff report, which is allowing the departments to have the flexibility to implement. Is that right?
Well, you'll need all three to ultimately
all
happen.
Three.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay,
that sounds good. All three options, every option we have.
Actually, it's the first two recommendations are to direct staff to create a telecommute policy and a flexible work schedule policy in detail, and then the third is to allow the third recommendation is
right.
to allow departmental flexibility with respect to the flexible work schedules.
Okay.
That's
what he said. And we had a second?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. We'll do it on a voice vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. And that concludes our morning's business. We have closed session coming up. I have no request to speak. On closed session, no one coming forward. We'll close it to the public, Mr. Jensen.
Somewhere between 1 and 2 hours.
All right, and yes. we will reconvene.
Is that ominous?
At or near 1:30. Thank you. Yeah, it was. Sure. Madam Clerk, we will reconvene the afternoon session, starting with a report out of closed session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board did meet in a closed session. No reportable action was taken.
All right. Thank you. I'll confirm Mr. Jensen's report there. We did have an item trailed from the morning, but we're still waiting on that, so we'll go ahead and have public comment. Items not on the agenda. I have two requests to speak, Ben DeFada, followed by Al Barrow.
Good afternoon, Ben DeFada. Having gone to Catholic school, I was always taught to respect my elders and don't question authority, but at my age now, I'm afraid I have to. In honor of the 20 years of the Berlin Wall being torn down, Subject today is Mr. Gibson tearing down his expensive stinking gravity sewer pipe for Los Osos. A wasting of $7 million studying only gravity. Then you come up with a 643-acre farm to blow away our good water in thin air. That's poor planning. Last week, your fellow board members told you how fed up they are giving you money for your potentially fraud-ridden and over-budgeted rework of the hated Tri-W Gravity Sewer project. So you moved it out of town. So what? It's still too expensive. Instead of dealing with cost-saving issues, Mr. Page filed a relief claim over. You let his claim for taking away his right to due process go to lawsuit, potentially holding up the EIR certification at least until May, and costing county taxpayers thousands in unnecessary legal costs. You manipulated our appeals, gone way out in the wee hours of the night. It's nothing but a Communist Party trick. Now you're fighting that manipulation in court. Shame on you, when all you have to do is rehear his appeal for free. And here's his papers. Los Osos low-income and middle-class homeowners are fed up with your manipulated bait-and-switch 218 vote, fake science, and stonewalling. Los Osos is fed up with your research misconduct about gravity sewers that will kill the very federal funding you're steamrolling the appeals process to try and get. The Paso Robles middle-class homeowners voted down your $100 a month water bills because you hid from them what the true cost would be up front. That Paso Robles tax search for Rue is the same tax dodge you're doing to Los Osos. Yes, Mr. Gibson, we know who gave you money for your last campaign. Main Street Los Osos County is fed up with high permit fees, endless red tape, and CD's 218 votes that take away our rights. On election day, maybe your time will be up. You can't spend money. We don't have any more. Our credit cards are tapped out. This county is ripping us off big time. You made Los Osos your cash cow. Mr. Gibson, no more studies of your stupid gravity pipe collection in BioLife treatment plant. You mentioned free money to help those who are unable to pay for their sewer bills. Where's this money coming from? You never brought it up. Well, it's coming from the other ratepayers for you keep forgetting to mention that Abu Dhabi, a country rich, has all the money they want. They had any project they could have picked. Here they picked vacuum because it's the best out there, not because it was the cheapest. I thank you, I guess. Thank you so much, I think.
Thank you, Mr. DeFano. Mr. Barrow.
Good afternoon, board members and public. My name is Alfred Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. I did ask the courts for relief on some of the issues involved in the sewer design and the various aspects of collection, treatment, and disposal. And I felt like, and I still do hold that, the county ignored a $100 million cheaper project. That's just, to me, unconscionable because you like the gravity collection system. And the gravity collection system, my expert witness will testify that it will leak and contaminate our water supply. The whole purpose of the sewer is to protect the water supply, isn't it, I believe? So why would we want to approach solving this problem with including a great risk of polluting a limited water supply that is soon to be limited to the upper aquifer primarily, which is where the collection pipes are? There's over 20,000 connections and joints that can leak in this. And county has, consultants have testified that they'll seal the part that they know is underwater 5 to 12 miles. But the other 50 miles will be free to leap. Well, normally that wouldn't be a bad thing, but we're in a liquefaction zone, we're in sand, we're in high groundwater, we're close to a bay, we're in Esha. We have multiple considerations on a very complex project, and you cannot say, in sum, this will be okay because it's going to protect us to a certain degree, and ignore all of the impacts and justify them by saying, well, these are overriding considerations. So it's my view that we need to correct some of these things, and I'm asking you to, whatever you have to do it. I know you're going to have a hearing on November 24th, to try to correct some of them. And it just doesn't seem conscionable to, number one, charge $100 million extra on the ratepayers, and number two, to have a choice of a sewer that will pollute the groundwater by leaking. And I have expert witnesses that will testify to that in court. So I just ask you that for the sake of all the people so we can all live in our homes in Los Osos. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. That was our last request to speak, so we'll close public comment. And let's take up the item we trailed from the morning session on the Title 29 Affordable Housing Fee Fund, the Affordable Housing Fund. Bench, we come back with a resolution implementing the tentative motion that we had from the morning.
That's correct. Your board directed staff to, let me start over. After considering the presentation by staff about the action plan and annual adjustment of fees for the Title 29 Affordable Housing Fund, your board decided or determined that it would accept the resolution, adopt the resolution for the action plan, but you wanted to amend the resolution regarding any annual fee adjustments. Your direction to staff was to make no adjustment to the fees at this time, to carry the existing fee schedule into the new fiscal year 2010-2011. And so that's what the resolution you have before you will do.
Okay. And the changes to, this is relatively minor modifications to the changes of the resolution that was presented in the board staff report?
The only change is to reflect that the existing fee schedule will be carried over to the next year.
Very good. All right. So I would then go ahead and entertain a final motion, Mr. Ashajian, on this resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we accept the resolution to adopt the annual adjustment for or fee increase to the in-lieu fee schedule and housing impact fee schedule of Title 29 Affordable Housing Fund.
You have a second?
Second.
Motion and a second.
Can I clarify, this does include the final action on the report as well?
That,
from the same motion morning.
In other words, if all your actions this morning were tentative ones, this makes them final in addition to adopting this resolution.
This resolution and the resolution, I believe, the motion maker and the second agree. And we will take that on a roll call vote.
Mr. Ashajian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
No.
Mr. Gibson?
No. All right. Thank you, Mr. Bench, Mr. McNulty. And Madam Clerk, you can introduce our final item.
Item E1 is consideration of a request to approve, one, a reimbursement agreement with the Napomo Community Services District to establish the feasibility of a joint powers or other appropriate agreement for the creation of an assessment district to fund capital improvements for the Napomo Community Services District water intertie project with the City of Santa Maria, and two, a corresponding budget adjustment in the amount of $25,000 from unanticipated revenue to fund the development of the agreement and related feasibility and analysis. Excuse me. Fourth District, recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Thank you. Mr. Ogren.
Chairman Gibson, members of the board, Mr. Clemens will be providing the staff report today on what I anticipate will be a relatively quick item, but before he gets started, we received emails about a week or so that the general manager for NCSD has resigned for health reasons, Mr. Bruce Buell. He's generally a pretty private individual, so I think I'll pass on, you know, discussing details other than it's pretty serious. Just wanted to comment in case Bruce happens to be listening today or individuals with NCSD. Certainly he has always had a high level of respect from individuals within the Department of Public Works for his, you know, work with the CSDs in the local region, and wish Bruce the best of luck.
Indeed. Thank you, Mr. Ogren. Mr. Clemens.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson, members of the board. I'm Will Clemens with your Public Works Department. This topic was introduced on September 22nd, 2009, during the Public Works Department's update of some water resource issues that are going on. And just as a recap of what we're talking about, the Napomo Community Services District desires to construct a water line intertie project with the City of Santa Maria, and that would be in cooperation with several private water companies, including Woodlands Mutual Water Company, Golden State Water Company, and the Rural Water Company. And these agencies have determined for various reasons that the most palatable way to fund this project would be through an assessment district. The NCSD has the ability to form an assessment district for their boundaries to cover their portion of the project costs. However, the private water companies do not. So they've asked for the county's assistance to form an assessment district that would cover the areas of all those agencies to fund this project. And this joint cooperative approach is consistent with the San Luis Obispo County Integrated Regional Water Management Plan, and it's also consistent with physical solutions that were identified in the Santa Maria Groundwater Basin litigation. So at the September 22nd meeting, your board directed staff to return with some possible criteria to include in any interagency agreement to get this to make this happen. And so that's what we've done today. We've included some possible criteria in our staff report. Of course, all of these criteria would be subject to legal review, and we present them for discussion purposes if you desire. But in addition to that, we've also come to you with a reimbursement agreement with NCSD for your approval, which would ensure that NCSD pays all costs associated with this action. And we've retained legal counsel Fulbright and Jaworski to help formulate the interagency agreements. We've worked with them before very successfully relating to the Lopez water system among the agencies in the South County, as well as forming the water delivery entitlement contracts for the Nacimiento project. So they've been very helpful in helping us formulate these interagency agreements, and this would be the first time we've really ever done an assessment district approach among different agencies. So again, NCSD would pay all the costs for this effort. We anticipate returning to your board with some draft agreements by the end of the calendar year, and Fulbright and Jaworski thinks that's a doable time frame. So today we're just asking for your approval of the reimbursement agreement as well as a budget adjustment in order to cover the costs of Fulbright and Jaworski to formulate these agreements. And I'm available for any questions that you might have.
Any questions, Mr. Clemens? I had one. I just wanted to be sure I understood how the money was flowing here. The unanticipated revenue of $25,000 is coming from the NCSD to get this going?
Correct.
And all I noted was on page 6 of our staff report in the reimbursement agreement, it says the district shall advance to the county the amount of $10,000.
Right. So we're asking for a $10,000 deposit just to get the cash flow, and then we will bill the NCSD as the costs come in. If they go above $10,000, we'll bill them, and they'll pay us for that.
Okay, up to $25,000 budgeted that we have.
Up to $25,000 for the legal work. However, there is no max to this agreement, so whatever it costs, and NCSD is on the hook for paying it.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, Will, is there going to be any ongoing administrative costs from the county?
Not for this effort of putting together the legal agreements, but those ongoing costs will be addressed in any interagency agreement that we bring back to your board for approval. And that's obviously we'd have in there terms and conditions where NCSD would be responsible for the cost of issuing the bonds and that effort, along with the annual collection of the assessments.
That will be covered in the MOUs.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no other questions, we will open it to the public. I have one request to speak. Mr. Jim Harrison.
Chairman Gibson, Honorable Board. I am Jim Harrison, the President of Pomo Community Service District, and we'd like to thank staff and the board for the support that we received so far. And we are supportive of this, and we'd hope that we would move it forward and expedite the process where we can get the water intertie built. And all the other agencies have expressed a willingness to support this.
Very good. Thank you. With that, and seeing no other members of the public coming forward, we'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Shadja.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move we approve staff's recommendation.
Second.
Motion and a second. We'll take that on a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Asajjan?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And that is the conclusion of today's business. We will reconvene 2 weeks from today on the 24th of November.
Short word for that.
Yeah, see?